Good morning, everyone. I trust everybody had a wonderful evening in London. It's kind of impossible not to. I'm Ken Mayer, and it's a great honor to introduce our speaker today for the Jonathan Mann Memorial Lecture on Grover. Jonathan Mann is somebody I had the pleasure and honor of knowing from the early days of the epidemic in Boston, who became a global leader in the fight for human rights, particularly around the issues of people living with HIV and AIDS. It is very fitting, then, for us to have Anand Grover, who has been a champion in India and throughout the world for human rights related to HIV/AIDS. He has successfully litigated cases around HIV discrimination early on. A colleague, Dr. Toku Yeptani, was able to be restored to occupation by virtue of his litigation. He also was chief counsel on the Novartis case. And also very relevant, I think, for human rights and HIV was the lead on the turning over of the Section 377, which penalized sodomy in India. He is now the Human Rights, the United Nations Human Rights Council Special Rapporteur on the right of everyone to the enjoyment of the highest attainable standard of physical and mental health. And this appointment was at the UN's ACE session in 2008. He is a practicing attorney in the Bombay High Court and the Supreme Court of India, and he took up his functions as Special Rapporteur on August 1st. Give you Dr. Mr. Anand Grover.
Well, thank you very much. I must apologize at the outside because, as the English people say, I'm under the weather. So I hope you'll be patient with me. I'm indeed honored to deliver the Jonathan Mann Memorial Lecture before this August gathering. It's appropriate that Mann's legacy be continued through such a series of lectures. Not only was he amongst the first to fashion the international response to the HIV epidemic, but more importantly, the first to bring to the HIV response the discourse of human rights and make it its central and integral feature. His legacy not only needs to be remembered, but also built upon, for his insights provide us critical ideas for our future work. Now that HIV is on the wane, it becomes necessary to take a look at what had happened from the early days when it was an emergency all over the world through when it became a treatable chronic ailment to the present phase when we are thinking of eliminating it altogether. The lesson it holds for us, especially the HIV and the human rights communities. During the early phase of HIV, it was difficult to identify people living with HIV because they were asymptomatic and healthy for a considerable period of time. Moreover, as HIV is also a sexually transmissible disease, it could spread across boundaries of race, class, nationalities, etc. Nobody was immune. Most importantly, HIV spelled a death sentence. This created a fear psychosis, stigma, and prejudice. It attracted unprecedented attention across the world, more so because HIV is detected first amongst white gay men in the United States. While this reinforced prejudice, it was perhaps fortuitous that HIV was indeed detected in the US, where a movement could mount a response at the time. Just imagine the situation if HIV had been detected amongst people in my country or a developing country. Though gay men were a marginalized community and discriminated against in the United States, the gay and lesbian movement had already picked up by the time HIV hit America in 1981. Community activism, combining both what I called direct experiential knowledge and intellectual knowledge of HIV, defined the text of the moment. Experience and pain gives one passion to climb mountains. Intellect, on the other hand, gives one the ability to keep on the right track. The unity of pain and experiential learning and passion and reason, intellect, and logic was to define activism on HIV all over the world. The classical public health response to pandemics involving communicable diseases was to test, identify, and isolate those living with the disease, what I call the isolationist response. In practice, in a number of countries, it was the marginalized communities that were targeted, the so-called high-risk groups of sex workers, drug users, and gay men. It has been rightly noted that into this moral and ethical fray entered Jonathan Mann with his insistence on logical and compassionate concern for each individual that led public health authorities to perhaps their finest hour. Later, Mann was able to identify the vulnerability of people to HIV on account of marginalization, stigmatization, and being discriminated against. In each society, Mann wrote that those people who were against, who were marginalized, stigmatized, and discriminated against before HIV/AIDS arrived have become, over time, those at highest risk of HIV infection. Mann was clear that without rights, HIV would proliferate. Mann thus called for respect for human dignity and social justice, insisting upon the necessity not only for economic development, but also for the protection of any population's health. With his passion and sheer logic, Mann was able to convince a large number of states to a compassionate and human rights-based response to HIV. It is this aspect of dignity that is central to Mann's thinking that I would like to tease out in this lecture. What then were the elements of the rights-based response to HIV? In the early days, till the mid-90s, there was no treatment for HIV. Without treatment, there was no incentive to know one's HIV status. Rather, to a person living with HIV, an HIV-positive result meant negative consequences. The biggest issue was how to tackle stigma and discrimination. As testing was directly linked to stigma and discrimination, the issues that this raised were no testing without informed consent, which emanated in the autonomy of an individual. Maintaining confidentiality of the person tested HIV positive, which directly related to his or her privacy. And of course, preventing discrimination, that is ensuring equality. All these human rights impinge on the dignity of the individual. They are the elements of the right to health approach, which I have elaborated elsewhere. In developing countries, this posed a huge problem, as these rights, except for discrimination by the state, were not entrenched in practice. Thus, in India, our first challenge was to introduce this specific set of ideas of rights discourse relating to the dignity of the affected individual into the HIV response. We did this by advocacy within the government, the medical profession, and simultaneously attempting to build confidence in the communities of people living with HIV, sex workers, drug users, and gay and transgender groups. Ultimately, the government in India adopted a rights discourse. Yes, informed consent, confidentiality, and non-discrimination were indeed introduced. However, there was a crucial difference in the way the marginalized groups were seen by the governments. In India, like in many developing countries, as Mann recognized, HIV was heterosexually driven. The key question for developing countries was to understand the dynamics of this transmission. Fortunately, epidemiologists recognized that the transmission among heterosexual population in India was primarily conduited by male clients to sex workers to clients, and then to their wives. Instead of preventing people living with HIV from marrying, as was being advocated, epidemiologists were able to successfully argue that what was needed was a program of high rate of condom use amongst clients of sex workers. This would be more effective in cutting HIV transmission, ultimately to housewives. The government followed the strategy of empowering sex workers to negotiate condom use with clients. A legitimate question does arise: why clients were not directly targeted for using condoms? Different governments followed variants of this strategy. There was the 100% condom use program in Thailand. In India, we followed the bottom-up approach. We had a good example to go by in the sex workers group in Shonagachi in Kolkata that enunciated the 3 R's to get sex workers to negotiate condoms with clients. They had the 3 R's. R for respect of sex workers, R for recognition of their wisdom, ingenuity, and capacity, and R for relying on their knowledge and skills as professionals. It was indeed rooted in the dignity of sex workers. the group themselves evolved a code of conduct. No condoms, no sex. The results in terms of preventing HIV transmission were impressive. Building on this pool of collective consciousness and human solidarity, the same group of sex workers today confront other social ills like human trafficking, violence against women, also extending support to other marginalized groups in society. This community-led model led to one of the largest programs of condom promotion through empowering sex workers. The results were there for all to see. A study later published in The Lancet vindicated this position. The strategy, loosely termed as harm reduction, was also adopted for injecting drug users, the clean needle syringe program, and amongst men having sex with men, condom promotion. This period saw the government encouraging the setting up of self-help groups of people living with HIV, sex workers, drug users, and gay men. This was unthinkable earlier. These networks were, apart from experience sharing groups, crucial in imparting information and knowledge on HIV and advocating their rights. Unlike all other epidemics before it, HIV was defined by the active participation of such networks, communities, combined with NGOs that exemplified the unity of intellect and emotion, reason and pain, science and passion to achieve paradigm shifts. While it was good that the government had taken up what we considered to be the rights-based approach on board, it is important to note that there was a crucial difference between our thinking and that of the government. To its credit, the government had, notwithstanding criminal laws, agreed to reach out to the marginalized groups. Over a period of time, we thought that this would evolve into addressing the issues of sex workers holistically, including punitive laws which impaired the rights and dignity of sex workers. This is where we were wrong. Governments did not look at these concerns the way we did. The government adopted a utilitarian strategy of using marginalized groups only to prevent HIV transmission, a public health goal. The same goes for the people who inject drugs. The strategy adopted was to provide clean needle syringes. However, other issues concerning the people who use drugs, particularly decriminalization of consumption and possession of drugs for personal use, though raised, were left unaddressed. Similarly, hepatitis C, a parallel epidemic amongst injecting drug users, which is transmitted in the same way as HIV, was largely unattended to in the developing world, such that even accurate data of the prevalence is not available. Thus, while HIV amongst injecting drug users was addressed, hepatitis was not. A person living with AIDS does not die today of AIDS-related complications, but because of hepatitis C or TB. That speaks volumes of the respect and dignity we accord to people who inject drugs. Fortunately, we were able to mold the response a bit, not through government action or advocacy, but through the judicial route. We challenge the infamous Section 377 of the Indian Penal Code, which criminalized sex relations on constitutional grounds. We got a very good decision from the Delhi High Court, which was based among other grounds on the grounds of human dignity. The court held that the offending section denies a person's dignity and criminalizes his or her core identity solely on account of his or her sexuality. It recalled a decision of the Canadian Supreme Court of Larue Dubé, which stated thus, "Dignity requires us to acknowledge the value and worth of all individuals as members of society. It recognizes a person as a free being who develops his or her body and mind as he or she sees fit. At the root of dignity is the autonomy of the private will and a person's freedoms of choice and action. Human dignity rests on the recognition of the physical and spiritual integrity of the human being, his or her humanity, and his or her value as a person, irrespective of the utility he can provide to others." The irony about the success of combating HIV is that, unlike in any other response to any disease in history, affected communities were central and to the success of the HIV response. Yet the same people do not matter anymore. And we are increasingly, and they are increasingly falling off the table. This, I would submit, is because human dignity has not been central to the HIV response. Today, in significant parts of the world, criminalization of same-sex behaviors continues, and at times with vengeance. HIV may have been contained amongst homosexual men with their full participation, but they face death penalties for being who they are. Similarly, a substantial number of countries criminalize consensual sex work or activities associated with it. New Zealand has shown the way, but dogmatic attitudes refuse to look at their legal model. The same goes for possession and personal consumption of narcotic and psychotropic substances. Portugal has pioneered a public health approach to drugs, but the ideologically driven war on drugs prevents its wider acceptance. Similarly, the Supreme Court of Canada allowed a supervised drug injecting facility to be continued. The court found that on balance, the potential denial of health services and the correlative increase in the increase of death and disease to injection drug users outweighs any benefit that might be derived from maintaining an absolute prohibition on possession of illegal drugs on the premises. Again, criminalizing HIV transmission is a major challenge, particularly in the developed countries. Such criminal laws infringe human rights, generally including the right to health, which requires non-discriminatory treatment and equality in respect of availability, accessibility, and acceptability of health facilities, goods, and services, and to respect, protect, and fulfill the rights of all persons, particularly the marginalized and vulnerable communities. Punitive laws disempowers communities and thus impedes access to such health services, goods, and services for them. Moreover, criminalization of social behaviors ultimately undermines the inherent value and dignity of individuals so targeted. This in turn diminishes their self-worth and further prevents the realization of the right to health and other human rights. Therefore, in my view, decriminalization of such conduct is absolutely necessary to address not only disempowerment, but also the dignity of the individual to enable the full realization of the right to health and other human rights. While the utilitarian model took over and relegated the dignity of the communities to the background, the advent of the triple combination ART in the mid-90s changed the human rights discourse in HIV radically, particularly on the issue of consent to testing, which had dominated the debate till then. While the triple combination treatment ART became available in the West, the people living with HIV in developing countries could not access ART even in 2000. Jonathan Mann had recognized this when he stated that of all walls dividing people in the AIDS epidemic, the gap between the rich and the poor is most pervasive and pernicious. A movement sprang up against this inequality in access to drugs in the international system, led by the South African activists. During the International AIDS Conference in Durban in 2000, Justice Edwin Cameron, an openly gay and HIV-positive judge, now the judge of the Constitutional Court of South Africa, put it thus: "In this, I exist as a living embodiment of the inequity of drug availability and access in Africa. My presence here embodies the injustices of AIDS in Africa, because on a continent in which 290 million Africans survive on less than $1 a day, I can afford monthly medication costs of about $400 per month. Amidst the poverty of Africa, I stand before you because I'm unable to purchase health and vigor. I'm here because I can afford to pay for life itself." The indignation at this inequality and injustice in matters concerning life and death reverberated globally. The call was for all persons from rich to poor countries, black or white, irrespective of gender, to have their right to life respected unequivocally through the provision of ART. The movement for treatment, another example of coming together of pain and passion, rationality and science, was able to garner support from around the world. The message was simple then. A paradigm shift was achieved. Indian generic companies were able to do this because of the Indian patent law from 72 to 2005, not only protected process patents, but product patents. This was consciously changed for a purpose, It may be noted that in 1972, India had among the highest prices for medicines in the world. Thereafter, competition flourished, and by 1990s, India had the lowest medicine prices in the world. Over a period of time, ART has become available around the world. Though even now, there are a significant number who need ART but are not getting it, the gap has narrowed considerably and continues to narrow. Indian generic companies are crucial to delivering ARVs to the developing world. They supply over 90% of ARVs at low cost to the developing countries. The ART rollout in a significant number of developing countries was not possible without the assistance of PEPFAR, the Global Fund, and UNITAID. These mechanisms need to be continued and strengthened if we want to tackle HIV and associated diseases of TB and malaria, and I would argue for the right to health itself. What did the availability of ART mean in terms of human rights? People living with HIV prioritized the right to treatment and non-discrimination over confidentiality and consent. The introduction of provider-initiated testing and counseling was hotly debated in intellectual circles in HIV, but hardly in the community fora. But despite opposition by human rights groups, including myself, PITC was adopted as the protocol internationally. That was possible because initiation of treatment, considered to be the most important for people living with HIV, necessitated that testing should be acceptable, even if it was without informed consent. Please appreciate that informed consent is fundamentally about the respect for the dignity of the patient, to equalize the otherwise unequal relationship in health settings between the doctor and the patient, obliging healthcare providers to impart information before testing, and encouraging health seeking by communities. The battle in trying to entrench informed consent in developing countries in healthcare settings may have been lost, but only temporarily. The scenario on access to medicines is changing yet again, which will surely impact human rights. Reality is a bit more complex now. India, being a signatory to the WTO, has signed the TRIPS agreement, which required it to introduce product patents. Indian companies may find it increasingly difficult in the future to supply ARVs in the same manner as they've done in the last decade. First, the multinationals are increasingly seeking to patent new molecules. Indian generic companies may find it difficult to oppose them. Second, a number of Indian companies are being bought out by international MNCs, both originating and generic. This would reduce the incentive for them to challenge patent applications. Thirdly, the European Union and the US are putting a lot of pressure on India through their trade representatives to change the Indian patent law for easier patenting and have used the medicine patent pool to enter into agreements with generic companies. This may imply inequity in the international scale, and this is ominous. In an era where science has pegged treatment as prevention, this means that the governments may want to start testing larger populations for HIV and start ART immediately. This will again raise the issue of consent and confidentiality. Can testing and treatment be carried out without informed consent? Moreover, most of the developing countries will not be able to afford this strategy from their own resources. We need to persuade governments to put in their money, but at the same time, we need to be able to expand and run global support for funding in a significant way and make it larger. Otherwise, it is likely that we may return to the days of 2000, where there was a divide between the developed and the developing world in the matter of treatment as also prevention. Simultaneously, in developing countries, there has been a move to integrate HIV services into the wider health delivery. That is inevitable. The response to HIV was vertical. That has been criticized. This response would have not been possible in the mainstream health system in the developing countries in the early stages, I would submit. The success outside in a vertical system lay in having it outside the main system. This allowed us to think out of the box and involve communities. It would now be possible to do that with the mainstream health system as pathways of the involved communities have been established. What is the way forward? Or should I say, what should be our agendas? There are opportunities staring in our face. The movement to integrate HIV into the health system is one. Treatment as prevention is the other. That apart, there is the 2014 MD agenda and thereafter of universal health care. These are opportunities where the lessons in HIV response can be taken and influence the field of health as a whole. We cannot afford to be parochial anymore. The HIV community has to start thinking of healthcare as a whole. We have to influence the outcome of the debate. In this context, we should seriously consider commitments from all states for health as a whole on a human rights paradigm. I would return to Mann, who understood the fundamental significance of human dignity in the debate about health and human rights. I would submit quickly that our agenda must include the following. Firstly, the respect for the dignity of life should be the defining context in the future of HIV and health response. When HIV services are mainstream, we would necessarily have to look at the individual's health as a whole, not in the parochial tunnel of one disease, HIV. The key issues like autonomy and consent would come up again and ought to become the backbone of the response based on entitlements and not give way to utilitarianism. Secondly, the HIV response should be based on full participation of communities affected with NGOs and civil society, exemplified, as I call it, by the unity of pain, experiential learning, and passion and reason, emotion and intellect. Communities have to be involved in policy making, implementation and monitoring and evaluation. Thirdly, we should ensure that drugs are available, accessible, and affordable. That would require resisting efforts of free trade agreements, bilateral investment, which won't increase and easy patenting. Fifthly, the experience of HIV response in the context of PEPFAR and Global Fund UNITED shows that funding must be available to purchase drugs, not only for the HIV response, but for the whole health system. A large number of countries simply cannot afford to fund health care. However, if we want to achieve a paradigm shift, we should not only increase funding to these entities, but think of increasing the coverage to the whole of health. In this globalized world, global solutions are necessary. A global convention on health, as was suggested yesterday, is the need of the hour. Let us work for it. I would end with man's sentiment. With logic, one can have good health care, but it will remain only clinical and cold without passion. It is the passion that makes the difference. Thank you. Thank you.